Bloody Elbow presents Show Money, the podcast that focuses strictly on the business side of combat sports. Here are your hosts, John S. Nash, Paul Gift, and Jason Cruz.
Welcome to Show Money, the only show exclusively dedicated to the business of mixed martial arts. I'm Paul Gift, the economist. With me, as always, we have Jason Cruz, our lawyer, John Nash, the man who knows everyone and everything in MMA. We are recording this on Sunday, January 23rd, and it's a special day today. We have our second guest ever, legendary boxing manager Kurt Imhoff, and attorney, and he's going to be joining us in the first portion of the day when we talk a little bit about Francis Ngannou, his contract situation, and some of his options after UFC 270 last night, and the Terrence Crawford lawsuit against Top Rank. So we'll start with that. John, why don't you introduce Kurt and start us off here.
Okay, well, Kurt Imhoff, everybody. There he is. Okay.
He's our number one fan
of the show. We were hesitant of let him come on because there goes 20% of our audience if he's on the show. So, but anyways, he's long time. I mean, like what, since early 90s you started in boxing as a manager? You've worked now.
Yeah, mid 90s, yeah.
As an advisor now to Ring City for a while, so you've covered the gamut. You've represented a lot of people. You also, MMA-wise, and we'll get into the context, you were the first person to reveal that the UFC contracts had a sunset provision after 5 years. And no one paid attention. No one, I noticed, but no one else noticed that news came out. So
I had no idea. That was probably like a tweet that I just threw out there.
You did. It was just a
forgot
tweet.
About.
And you thought it was standard. You go, well, the UFC has these they have 5 years. Everybody knows that. No, we don't.
And you know what? I saw that tweet, and I didn't even see that tweet when he made it. Like, I saw that you linked to it, John, but I don't even remember it at the time. So I missed it, too.
Well, it stuck. I've repeated it several times in articles because I've always questioned it. It goes, is this the new standard? But I haven't seen enough contracts yet. But anyways, to get to the first subject, we're going to talk about Francis Ngannou's contract, how he just last night won, defended the UFC heavyweight championship on what was his last fight of his 8-fight, 40-month contract that took 50 months to finish, but still, 8-fight contract, 40 months, that last fight last night, he wins it. Now the UFC can initiate what's called the championship clause. The championship clause extends it 3 fights or 1 year, whatever's less, but then there's all this stuff with tolling provisions. But the big thing is, Francis confirmed himself, his manager confirmed, and I did an article on this, on these changes to the UFC contract. He has a sunset provision after 5 years. That 5-year period would come next December, January, around there. So no matter what, he could basically sit out, recoup his knee, and exit the UFC as a free agent if he wants. I say I'm pretty sure this is the result because I spoke to a lot of guys that know about combat sports, attorneys and stuff, one of which was Kurt Imhoff. So if I get anything wrong, we know who to blame because he looked over some of these details. I showed him some of the – plus he'd seen the previous contract. So, Kurt, we'll start with you, the guest. You need to go first. Do you think that based on what you saw and what you know, do you think that Ngannou's right that if he sits out, you know, recouping his leg, whatever – that next year he will be a free agent?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's in, there's the one thing I was kind of iffy about. I'm like, okay, well, if there's an injury clause in there or if there's, you know, some sort of clause in there that extends it, you know, beyond that sunset term, but that the sunset term, I believe, if memory serves me correctly, it's in the same paragraph as the injury stuff, and it's also what's addressed in there, from what I recall, is the fact that if the fighter just decides he's not going to fight, he's not going to compete for whatever reason, it's still the sunset clause swallows that up. Like,
I'll interrupt real briefly, but if I recall, it says that the terms in this Article 4 terms, the sunset provision covers all the other provisions in that section 4, and that section 4 has all the tolling provisions for injury or skip not wanting to fight, all those extensions, so they would be covered under that sunset clause.
Yeah, it's one of those great drafting clauses, you know, notwithstanding the foregoing, all that stuff above But, basically, you know, it's just not going to extend beyond the 5 years. It's not going to extend beyond 5 years from the effective date of the contract.
I'm going to go to Jason, throw both of you. The beauty is we have two people that actually know legal stuff, where me, just the idiot.
And two people that fake it.
Yeah.
Well, which ones are
exactly.
Truth is, me and Paul.
Guess who? Who's who?
Me and Paul know what we're talking about. But Jason, you brought up something before that your question was about him sitting out. If the UFC would maybe file a lawsuit against him for not a bad faith, right? So you want to go to that, and then we can Kurt can, me and Paul can just sit back and drink tea and relax.
so my one question about that, of course, is with a championship provision, it extends the length of the contract. The question I would have then is, the UFC would probably offer Ngannou some fights, no matter what, whether or not he likes it. And they could presumably, if they wanted to get nasty and down dirty with it, they could probably file a lawsuit saying, assuming that Ngannou says no to all of those fights, he turns them down. And they basically say, the UFC says, hey, we're suing you for breach of the, implied duty of good faith and fair dealing and contract. And what that basically says, and I to be honest with you, editors, no, I really hate that clause. It's really the duty of implied good faith and fair dealing basically means that you have to be honest and faithful. Both parties have to be honest and faithful to the agreed purposes of the contract. So you're acting in good faith that you're going to enter into contract and you're going to do all of the things that you agreed to when you signed the dotted line, when you agreed to that. And so the UFC could say, hey, Francis, you knew that you were sitting out a whole year and not going to take any of the fights we offered you. I mean, I'm sure they would do something along the lines of what they did with GSP and say, hey, we offered you this person, we offered you that person, and you turned them down. So what we're going to do, Francis, is we're going to sue you because you didn't act in good faith with the terms of your contract, which is, you agreed to the championship clause. And when you won, it automatically triggered this clause in the contract. So that's what I mean. So that is something that I could see the UFC doing if they wanted to, or they could offer a buyout provision or something like under that lines. I don't know what you think, Kurt. I mean, you're much more into the business than I am, but that are my thoughts just from the contractual legal perspective.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I guess, my thoughts as someone who represented fighters for many, many years, I mean, I would, my argument would be, whether it's right or not, we'll see. But my argument would be, the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing is generally, it's a cause of action you can bring on the contract, where it's not about an explicit breach of the contract, but where some conduct kind of violates like the spirit of the contract or frustrates the purpose, because that's a whole different cause of action. Yeah. But violates like the spirit of the agreement kind of thing, like someone not acting in bad faith. And I guess my argument would be actually what I just kind of stated about the contract. I mean, this is contemplated in the contract. It's not something that's not dealt with in the contract. Like, refusing to compete is contemplated in the contract. It would be a breach of the contract, right? You're alleging a breach of the implied, good faith and fair dealing, but you're already dealing with it in this clause. You're saying that if the guy refuses to compete for whatever reason, so you can't bring this catch-all, implied covenant, because it's already dealt with explicitly in the contract. That it's contemplated that he may refuse to compete. So I would say you have the notwithstanding the foregoing that specifically addresses that issue of refusing to compete. I would say that, there's your argument that, you can't bring that cause of action. And another thing I'd say as well with Ngannou, what is bad faith? What is good faith? Like, let's say they offer him what they offered him for his last fight. And Ngannou is of the belief, and probably has a very good faith belief, that he's going to make a hell of a lot more money, on the open market. So it's like, no, you know, I'm not contractually obligated. You know, I'm out of fights, right? We're done with the fights. You know, I've done all the fights. All right, you're going to make me an offer. You better make me an offer, you know, in good, you need to make the offer in good faith that's in line with what's out there in the market. Otherwise, I have every right to turn it down, you know, in good faith, because I know I can make a lot more on the market. And why would I risk that to fight for chump change for you?
Now, that's not, no. MMA fans will tell you that if you sign the contract, you have to fight every fight for what they're going to pay, no matter what the conditions. They will tell you that. You don't know what you're talking about.
So now we know what manager Kurt says to Dana White or Hunter Campbell as a negotiation. So,
I do have one follow-up, Kurt. So this sunset provision, I haven't seen the sunset.
What do you mean? I sent it to you.
Wait, you didn't send it to me either, did you?
No one sent it to you. Anyway, no. Anyway, so assuming.
Oh, shit. Maybe I didn't hit send on the email. I was pretty sure I did. Okay.
Anyway.
No, we're still waiting.
So assuming this sunset provision, the notwithstanding, I mean, this is like 1L law school thing where you go in contracts, you talk about what each word means. And so this notwithstanding, you occur, is like a broad swath, and it seems to you're saying this supersedes any of this good, duty, covenant of good faith and fair dealing. That's what you're saying, because of the sunset provision says it ends in X amount of in a year's time from when you win.
Well, I think just, you know, because you're explicitly talking about them making him offers and him refusing them. And I'm just saying that's dealt with explicitly in that paragraph. I think it's in paragraph 4 somewhere that they contemplate, you know, when, as they're tolling the contract, you know, before you hit that sunset provision, let's say he's turning down fights in year 2, they can toll the contract for the time that he's like not fighting and refusing to train or refusing to compete or he's injured. It's all, I think it's all in the same paragraph where they talk about if you do this, you do that, you do this. I mean, it's in boxing, you know, same thing in boxing contracts. I mean, it's all combat sports, but yeah, I mean, I think it's explicitly in that paragraph, and this sunset provision like says, you know, notwithstanding the foregoing within this paragraph, whatever, none of the extensions in this paragraph shall extend beyond the, you know, 5 years.
I'll quote it really quick so we get right. This is the one I've seen in several of them.
Thank you.
I've seen in several of them, but notwithstanding the foregoing, the agreement will not be extended pursuant to this section 4 beyond the date, which is 5 years after the effective date of the agreement. Now, section 4 covers all the previous articles in section 4 is stuff like, if you turn down a fight, we can extend it 6 months. If you get injured, we can extend it the length of your injury or 6 months. So all that stuff. So, oh, and also the championship clause is in section 4. So I'm taking it. You two legal geniuses and me, the dude sitting here, that covers all those.
And really quick, just for the people listening, Ngannou, right, just for instance, Ngannou is the man of the moment. He's about to get champ extended, right? And his 5 years will run out in January of next year. So the champion's extension, especially important since Ngannou is injured, what did he tear his meniscus? It was that would normally get told, right? And so now he's got basically that hard cap of January 2023. Just throwing that in. Sorry, go ahead.
What's also interesting is that Ngannou, I saw this not in Ngannou's contract. I've seen this now, I don't know, at least a dozen contracts. I looked, okay. So at least in no fighter I saw since mid-2017 didn't have this and the other provisions I wrote about in their contract. So Ngannou might not be the first person. I mean, he just might be the first, but he might not be the last person that can fight out their contract. There might be, in fact, there's some fighters that seem like they're on their fourth year or whatever. In fact, GSP basically confirmed, you know, he's looking at, he's no longer a young chicken and stuff, but GSP, his contract ends, he was saying, you know, almost 2 years, but when he said it, but that would line up right when he last fought with the UFC in 2018. So there's going to be other fighters, I guess. So does this change things? What does this mean? Is this?
Yeah, that's definitely such an interesting question. I mean, you know, because you've had, these guys have, you know, I mean, obviously that's what the lawsuit's about, is that these contracts would go in perpetuity and, you know, they monopolize the market. There's nowhere else to go. And that's the big question now. You've got arguably one of the biggest stars in the sport who is actually going to be effectively a free agent. And, you know, John, I know you love this stuff. You know, I mean, you know, what drives up wages? It's competition, right? So is there competition out there who can actually, you know, make something of Ngannou and grow their own business with it and become a place where UFC fighters who have their contracts coming up are going to be like, wow, I want to jump ship. I want to go there because they're paying more money than the UFC.
Before we go into that, I'll just say this. I think there's places Ngannou can go to make a lot of money. Not all those places are places that other fighters are going to be able to follow him to go. I think there's people following, fans of the show. No, there's certain promotions just wash with cash. That doesn't mean they might have cash for him now. And so Ngannou might make it just a ton. You know, there's PFL out there full of a lot of money. There's one championship sitting on a lot of money. I don't know where it comes from, but they got it. There's Triller just spending money like drunken sailors. All of them could probably make a huge offer to Ngannou, which is good for the next year or two, but I don't know if several years down the road, the next fighter, the next wave of fighters coming out are going to be like, oh, great, that Triller money is just waiting for me.
Well, I mean, you guys have seen this before, though, right? I mean, you know, name an organization that fell by the way. I mean, wasn't it, what's the one with the t-shirts?
Oh, Affliction.
Yeah. Didn't Affliction pay a ton of money to you?
They did.
Free agent possible who had a name they put on their cards, and they lasted about a year.
they did have their big events were at the Honda Center, which they had it. Yeah,
they made it to two events and never got to the third. But the thing interesting Affliction too is like they did everything. They might have overpaid but they paid for a ton of fighters, then put them all on one event, which people are paying basically to see Fader beat up someone. And so there's no return. It's not like they go, oh, here's what we'll do. We'll put Fader on this pay-per-view or this one card, and then we'll spread everybody out on Showtime and have Showtime pick up the majority or all their purses. They're like, we're geniuses. We'll keep adding. It's a multiplier effect.
It's a bad business model. But I wanted to pick Kurt's brain here. As far if you are Ngannou's management, do you just let him wait out the year? I mean, he's 35. He's not a spring chicken. Does he wait out the year and just weigh his options? Or I mean, what do you do? And then on the flip side, if you're Hunter Campbell for the UFC, do you offer him fights, or does it, you know, what happens?
I mean, I think it wouldn't be smart not to listen, you know, especially the UFC. I don't follow the sport anywhere near as close as you guys do, but I did a little research and I was looking at, who UFC has, who Bellator has, who ONE has, who PFL has. And the bottom line, I mean, first of all, the heavyweights are really thin, man, in MMA. There's not a lot of guys. And Ngannou's pretty much mowed them all down, you know, the interesting fights. UFC, what? There's maybe three, you know, reaching a fourth fight that's really, really interesting. I mean, you know, maybe a third fight with Stipe. I don't even know if Stipe's fighting anymore, right? I mean, that would be maybe of interest, even though he knocked the shit out of him in the last fight. Rematch with Derek Lewis, obviously is pretty big because Lewis beat him. I mean, so there's intrigue. And you guys tell me, I don't know what's going on with John Jones. That seems to have been the biggest fight. Could have been the biggest fight in MMA, could still be the biggest fight. I mean, if the UFC can dust Jones off and keep him out of jail,
that's harder than you say.
I don't think anyone knows what's going on with John Jones, by the way, but
didn't he, I mean, he got off from the criminal charges though, right? They didn't file charges, so he theoretically could fight. But he also is someone who's like, show me the money, right?
Well, he did retain Richard Schaefer as his representation, so I don't know how that's going to work out as far as dealing with Dana or whatnot. But
I don't know how it's going to work out, period. But
the options for Ngannou is like, if this was 10, 11 years ago, it's just a world of difference. The heavyweight champion, 11 years was, I think, Kane had just won it. If Kane had won it and left the UFC, well, at that point, Strikeforce was sitting there with Vader and Verdum and Overeem. And, you know, there's like, oh, there's all these, and, you know, these big fights. There's tons, one after another pay-per-view we could line up and make money. And Ngannou leaves. That's why I think it's going to be like a venture capital money is going to be the one that's going to buy just as a way to sell their operation. Like PFL might, I think, come up with a bunch of money and say the winner of our tournament fights Ngannou.
But did you see who the winner of their tournament was?
Yeah, I don't think, no, but I'm not saying people are actually interested in that, but I'm saying that's
Bruno Capoloza. I mean, who is that, man?
Let me throw out a question I have for you guys, not just Kurt. Anyway, by the way, if you're listening to this and not watching, Kurt has this awesome Zuffa boxing shirt on. Where I think we're all jealous. We all want it. We all want one. but so let's say the year goes by, right? We get to January of next year, 2023, and he becomes a free agent. I think we learned from John that he probably actually doesn't have a 90-day exclusive negotiating period, probably, right? Is that what we probably learned from you, John? But he has that one-year restricted free agency. So we know what happens if he gets an offer from another MMA promotion. But what if he went and tried to go box? How do you guys think the restricted free agency would work in that case? Would that apply, not apply? What do you think?
I mean, from what I recall of the clause, you know, it's funny how you can word these things, the right to match and how you can counter the moves. I mean, I've had, you know, right to match is also exists in boxing, you know, and you know, right of, you know, first negotiation, you know, last refusal or right to match. So, you know, what's interesting about, I believe the UFC's is that they only have to match the financial terms. I mean, they've made it very narrow because a lot of the ways you could, if they would say we have a right to match the offer and make it general, you could put all kinds of little things in there that, you know, will trip someone up in trying to match it. But they literally only have to match the financial terms. So, you know, maybe, I mean, listen, you know, it, with boxing, it does seem like there's a lot of interest because everyone is licking their chops. They can't wait to fight Francis because they don't think he's very good at boxing. But he's a big name, and they've seen with, you know, Triller, if anyone's proven it, and even Showtime, I guess, if they've proven anything, it's that, you know, there's a lot of crossover with these pay-per-views if you have a UFC star in there. So I think, you know, I think there is going to be a lot of money. There's going to be a lot of interest, somebody. And I think whoever said Triller first hit it on the head. To me, that's clearly the leader of the pack, although certainly not the only one who's going to have interest. But, you know, I think I was telling John a couple days ago, I mean, Triller is paying like so far above market in boxing. It's just, it's, I don't know how they're staying afloat, but they are. And I mean, I told him, I mean, I can't divulge the number, but I know that, you know, what Holyfield got paid for that thing, it was like high, you know, seven figures for his last fight. And originally he was going to get paid that same amount to fight Kevin McBride. Okay. Who somehow beat Mike Tyson in Mike Tyson's last fight, but Kevin McBride was just a very average, just bad heavyweight. And now we're like 10, 15 years on, 20 years on. So they have a ton of money to spend, and they have this new thing, Triad, which in all honesty, I thought the MMA fighters held their own in Triad. I didn't watch the event. I saw highlights of poor Frank Mir getting knocked the F out again. But you know, guys like Mike Perry beat a pretty good boxer, actually. Michael Seals, Derek Campos beat Brian Vera, who's at one time a decent fighter. So, and pretty much since they've lost Mike Tyson and Jake Paul, they need a big attraction.
So wait. So what you're saying is that Ngannou's got to talk to the UFC and convince them to release him from the champ the last year early, so he can get on Triller before they go out of business, because he now before that dries up, because
he's going to be free next year. They're going to be like, sorry, we just spent our last buck. No more investors.
Here's a question for you again, Kurt. So tell me, you guys chime in too if you're wrong. My thinking is, for Ngannou, he's not, his market's not really Showtime could afford to pay him several million probably to beat up, you know, their whatever heavyweight they got to for their brand. But they can't do big numbers. They're not the type of people that would just throw money. I think it's a Triller, a one, and a PFL is a chance because they have to. They could use him as a loss leader. We're willing to spend millions on him to get attention. But I was thinking the next wave of guys that could possibly come out, if a Nate Diaz is supposedly up, but I've heard rumors that Max Holloway might only have a couple fights left. Then you got Conor. But if Max Holloway and Nate Diaz, well, those are type of fighters that Showtime, I think, might get. Those is when Showtime would step in because, like, I can put those guys on pay-per-view and I can give a big split and we'll still make money. We're not looking at as a loss leader. We're here to make money, and these are the types of – I mean, I could be wrong, but is that what you guys thinking on who could be going for these people?
All right, guys. I mean, you guys know Bellator better than I do. I would assume that's who what you're talking about is, like, making Bellator deeper. I mean, if that's a good play for Bellator.
Well, I couldn't figure out. Were you talking about Bellator or Showtime for boxing?
I was saying more because Showtime would make the decision. Bellator is just the brand. I don't think even the guys coming over, like Nate Diaz, I don't think he would sign with Bellator. Nate Diaz would sign with Showtime because they can get him a Jake Paul pay-per-view boxing match. And right. Then if he signed with Showtime, they might say, oh, Max Holloway or someone else like that's a free agent. We can put you two together in a pay-per-view. And so on Bellator, but it's not, I don't see it as a Bellator move. I see it more as Showtime making those decisions.
That's assuming that both Holloway and Diaz want to box. Is that what you're saying, John?
Yeah. Or fight MMA, whatever it is, but those are the type of fights you could put Holloway, you could put Diaz, McGregor, Holloway, Diaz, any AJ McKee possibly in that mix with those guys, though, all those guys, MMA or boxing, you could put those on pay-per-view. Where that's where I think like a Showtime would come in the mix, be interested. I don't see that happening with Ngannou. There's no opponent that you can put against Ngannou right now where like we can pay him millions and just air it on Showtime and make our money.
Well, for me, and I mean, maybe it's a long shot, but I mean, what would be a massive fucking pay-per-view? If Jake Paul was willing to steroid up about another 30 pounds... with all the enmity he has gotten with the UFC crowd, they would love to see him squashed like a bug by an Ngannou. That would be a massive. And he's fighting at 190. So yeah. It's not completely out of the question that he could steroid up about 20 pounds, 25 pounds.
80-20 split, maybe you can get Ngannou. I mean, Ngannou might do it for a 20% split. 80 might be enough to get Jake Paul to walk. It's worth it.
I mean, how many pay-per-views do you think that would do? I mean, Jake's doing what, between 600 and 800, fighting guys who, he's going to beat.
They could do that with Jake Paul and Nate Diaz if they meet at 180, 185. I mean, I could see that happening. And that would be, I would think, a million-dollar pay-per-view because you'd get great crossover from the MMA community and everyone, like the Diaz brothers are niche. They don't have to win. They just do their thing and people right. love them. Yeah. And people love Jake Paul no matter what. What do you think of him? He's someone to watch.
Make a video of Nate Diaz and some nunchucks yelling at Jake Paul. There's a million buys right there.
Oh my God. Yeah. I mean, it didn't even have to be a good fight. I mean, it would sell its, I mean, I think the shoulder programming and the lead up would be much more entertaining than the actual fight probably, but it would sell well.
What's interesting is all the fighters I could see leaving the UFC are basically the guys we've mentioned who've been in the UFC for years at the end, and they might be doing big numbers if they leave the UFC, but I don't, they're, to me, it's not like if Nate Diaz goes somewhere, that doesn't suddenly make this a super appealing place for all the other fighters, because there is no named ranked guys for them to fight still there at Bellator or wherever. So there's a kind of one-offs. And I think that's kind of the UFC setup is that they've agreed to this because they know it's like, yes, we might lose some guys, but the people we're losing are only going to hurt us for a couple fights that we've lost. Mm-hmm. And we make so little from variable revenue now. Actually, in some ways, we might gain because these are the guys we got to pay more, and we make just as much from someone that makes a lot less.
Yeah. Do you think it really hurts the UFC if Ngannou, makes a lot of money somewhere else? I could actually see him just kind of doing one-offs with a lot of these places, and he's 35. If he can do that for like four or five fights, how much longer does he want to stick around if he's making tens of millions of dollars?
I think for him, it's more about the money now, and that's fine. But I mean, you know, it's
prize fighting. Of course,
it's fine. But you got these other guys that are willing to take a pay cut and everything like that to stay with the organization. But I think like Ngannou has been, understands where he is in the market, and he understands his age, that he doesn't have much time left to do this at a high level. I mean, he could do it into his 40s. We see everybody trying to come back, the Oscar De La Hoya, Roy Jones, they come back. I mean, but, you know, to do this at a high level and make the peak amount of money, you know, that's what I think Ngannou is looking for at this point. And so that makes it an interesting point about what he does in the next year. Does he sit out? Does he, does he wait? I mean, I it's hard because he's 35. I mean, if he was 25, it'd be easy to sit out and just hang out on the beach for a year. You know, that would be the way to do. But like, I don't know what he or his team want to do in the near future.
I would actually I would ask all those fights that are potentially big fights for Ngannou, the three or four other guys in the UFC, what year did you sign your contract? Because that'll be the deciding factor.
Exactly.
If it was 4 years ago, you sit out with me for a year, and then we can keep all the money somewhere else when we fight. So,
absolutely. Well, I mean, I think he's kind of got a built-in excuse as well. I mean, did he not just take that fight with like an ACL and MCL? I mean, guy needs to go get some surgery and heal up and chill out for a little while. That'll kill at least 6 months of it.
I know. It might make his decision for him, kind of.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah,
I mean, way. But what if they offered you the John Jones fight, like in November or December of next year? Do you take that if the pay is right? Well, I guess, I mean, it's not the big part of the pay for you is the pay-per-view points, right? So that's already in there. Do you take that, or do you just go to become a free agent?
Well, are you talking to me or Kurt?
I'm talking to all three of you.
Oh, well, I think I would weigh the numbers. I mean, I would look at, you know, what do they think it's going to sell? And then what, I mean, you can't do it on this current deal. You'd have to write a side. You'd have to say, listen, you're going to offer me John Jones. You either write a new contract or you write a side letter with some new terms for this specific fight. Because, I mean, right now, Ngannou's getting $600,000 a fight plus pay-per-view point. That's not much. I mean, one and a half million buys. I mean, and he would get like $3.5 million. That's it. And what he has now, because he didn't, you know, we know he doesn't have a side letter because he didn't sign a new deal. They hold that off for the champions. So that's what I'd be. So what's the total amount? What's the guarantee you can give me? And if it's a number that me and my management, we've already decided that that's our minimum, then I take it. Otherwise I'll wait a year. But do you think he really has these big guys want to fight him. How much realistically do you think like a Fury or a Wilder against him, he could make in that? I mean, we know he ain't winning, and we know he might not fight again after that. I mean, the rule I would have, I'd ask Fury, you cannot come in under 320 pounds. I mean, you're incredibly out of shape.
Yeah, I think he should fight Fury like under the triad rules, but I think they should throw one more thing in there because, I mean, you know, what I loved about, because I did watch his last fight. I liked, you know, Fran Beeb and Ganamedov, man. I love the takedowns, the slams. Like, at least have a Tyson Fury have to defend a takedown, you know? I mean, you know, go that far, you know? I mean, no ground and pound, but, you know, give Ngannou the option of picking him up and
bring back him. London prize ring rules. The old London
there
prize
you go. Ring. Exactly.
He's supposed to be the Gypsy King, bare knuckle champ. Come
there
on.
There you go. We're back to the roots, man. Yeah. I mean, it's a fair offer. I mean,
do you see that possibly big enough that could pay Ngannou enough that'd be worthwhile to him? That's the thing. I'm just not sure. I think he could sell, but the split that a major boxer would want to do something that demeaning.
Well, also too, what's interesting is you're talking, you know, Fury's with Top Rank on ESPN. Is ESPN really going to want to piss off the UFC with basically aiding and abetting the UFC heavyweight champion with leaving the UFC and you know, for greener pastures in boxing? I mean, it's, you know, it's a tough one. I'm sure Dana would definitely be in their office and in their face about it if they made it. But I mean, you know, listen, even, you know, we talked about Showtime maybe, you know, Jake Paul. I don't know if that's going to happen, but I mean, PBC in general, you look at, you know, they've talked about maybe Deontay Wilder. You know, Wilder's coming off of two losses, but he has a lot of visibility. He's an exciting fighter. You know, he's done decent on pay-per-view. I think actually his pay-per-views with Fury have, for the most part, done a little better than Ngannou's pay-per-views, right? I mean, what's Ngannou's best pay-per-view?
Oh, I'm not sure. The
problem is it's hard to know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he's
boxing too.
Yeah. He's only, I would say, a couple. But look, I mean, but if it did, let's say, because of digital buys, if it did, let's say, 500,000 buys, that's still over 20, 25 million they could split.
Right. So it's awesome money and more money than, you know, it's like exponentially more money that he's making in the UFC. So no brainer for him. You know, no brainer for him. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was thinking about it. I'm like, okay, you know, would you know, if Anthony Joshua gets beat by Usyk again, is that a viable one? I mean, you know, I mean, Eddie Hearn came up with an ungodly amount of money in the Middle East for Joshua Fury. I mean, if he and Ngannou did it.
I didn't think about that, but honestly, that Saudi Arabia might be in the ballpark. This is the type of weird crap that they might throw millions at.
Absolutely. And they love Anthony Joshua. So, I was thinking, you know, if Usyk beats Joshua twice, you know, all these guys, like I said, they'd love to fight in Conor. They all believe it's going to be a huge event. You know, it's going to be great crossover. And I was like, listen, you know, if Triller is out there and they're looking for an opponent, you know, I've heard and I know that Vladimir Klitschko has been staying in the gym. He's perfect for this. Triller would pony up, like, you know, probably over 10 mil for both guys, at least, you know, as a guarantee and pay-per-view upside. I mean, you know, if Ngannou's management is sharp and really, you know, I mean, obviously at this point in time, they got to go back channel. Third parties, you know, deep throat type stuff.
I just want to, if you're speaking that kind of money, I want to let it know that Ngannou, I'm now your management. So, you don't have to ask that. Just send me my cut. That's all I'm saying.
Let's the signal, yes. Disappearing messages.
Yeah.
But this would all hinge on him being a free agent, right? But I think we can all safe to assume that if he does become a restricted free agent and he gets an offer like that, there's no way in hell the UFC is going to match that, right? So, even though they could match those terms, I don't think anyone sees them doing it, right?
That's what I was thinking. I'm like, does the UFC, I mean, how valuable is Ngannou to them? Like, right. Like, you know, would they justify it by saying, listen, we just had to match an offer. That's why we're paying him more than the rest of you guys who were totally stiffing. All right. I mean, hey, you know, we're just doing the right to match, you know?
It's weird because I think in the Fertitta era, the Fertittas would do whatever it takes to hold the number one heavyweight. Like, we are not letting if it was Fertitta era, he'd be frozen out and he'd be sitting on a shelf for years now waiting for him to feel like that. But I mean, that's the difference. It is strange. Everybody has fond memories of Fertitta era, but I got to say, as much as we mock and Endeavor, the changes they made, the contracting stuff, the behavior, they let Ngannou fight for the title with only one fight left. That's something Lorenzo Fertitta never would allow it. So they're generally much softer, you know, hands with the fighters. But if this is the Fertitta era, they would never let the number one heavyweight leave. They would do whatever it takes to retain them. And I think that's what's kind of interesting is Endeavor. I think they made up their mind. They're willing to I do not think Ngannou is going to end up being the last person in this position that's going to leave or get a chance to fight for the title and then have a chance to leave. I think they've made up their mind. We have such a position in the market. We do not need to be tyrannical like we used to.
Well, that's my big question to you guys who know MMA. It's like, you know, is there an AFL to the UFC's NFL? You know, is there anyone who's got enough money that if to make it, you know, a plausible shot at having there be like a, you know, this be like a bellwether moment where suddenly there's this huge, you know, run of UFC fighters to that organization. I mean, Bellator? No, they just don't have the budget. They can't deal.
No, I mean, these guys, I'm sure, will say something similar, and I'll let them speak for themselves. But I think it's that maybe okay, come back 10 years from now, maybe we'll be shocked that we were wrong, and there is now an AFL to the UFC's NFL or ABA to their NBA. But I see it being one-offs that people could compete with UFC on an individual fight, you know, if they have a Jake Paul opponent, but they can't. The roster, the depth, the contractual revenue, all that stuff together, the ingrained memory of where to go to find the best fighters. I mean, Paul, you follow, you read Jason, you.
Yeah, no, I think that MMA for the mainstream person is branded as UFC. When they talk about MMA, they say, oh, UFC. So I think it's just the fact that UFC has just now surpassed so much in terms of getting over that hump of being more of a mainstream player in the sports market. They're on ESPN. They now are just making money over money. I mean, their money has money. That's how much money they have. I mean, we're talking sponsorship deals. We're talking licensing deals, and they're expanding globally. Once they have media deals that are going to end this year overseas, and you know that they're going to get the licensing deals are going to get jacked up even higher. Their advertising rates are going to go up. Everything is looking bright for the UFC. It's helped. I mean, my God, this is the one sport that has benefited from the pandemic. For whatever you think about it, they have done the best in terms of holding events. And then when they came back strong. The gates have just aided them. And the fact of the matter is, they don't pay the fighters that much. So they're making just hand over fist with the money. And I think that what we're seeing now is that 2022 is going to be a monster year for the UFC. I think that, I mean, I think that maybe they'll have a little bit of competition from, you know, like John said, one-offs from other organizations based on the fact that casuals will kind of get into it and maybe see a Bellator event or a PFL event here or there. But it's all MMA is going to be UFC for most individuals.
Yeah. And to me, Bellator is basically locked in as number two, right? They know what they're doing. They know the way they run their business. They're profitable promotion. Right. So would they want Ngannou? Absolutely. But they would be strategic about it. They would want him at the right price. Whereas you've got these other promotions that are still trying to survive, and flush with money. Right. So those are the way, you know, I kind of think of it like actors right now with all the, and everybody that's craving content and streaming platforms and things of that sort. Right. They're not all going to survive. But some of them are trying to survive and they're bidding on content like crazy. So I would be counting on one of those other ones to probably not. I mean, like Bellator would love to have him, but I don't think they would end up getting him. He would want to go to whoever, basically, yeah, 35 years old. What's the highest bidder for my next few fights? And the most important ones would be the next one or two, because some of these promotions might run out. I don't know if they'd be gone before my contract's over.
Tip to Ngannou. One fight contracts at a time. That's it. Get your one fight. Yeah. Have a short sunset on each of them. But that's what I was saying earlier. I don't think, I mean, Bellator, like I said, I think they can afford to pay $3-4 million for him to beat up their whatever Chick Congo or, you know, Bader or whoever they have. But that's, you're not going to make money on that. And that's the most they can offer them. Where Bellator Showtime can make a big difference is where an opponent is available to them. Like if a 145 pounder becomes available, one of the top 145, that's something Bellator can get him, because now we have AJ McKee. We have someone to make a big fight. And that's where I think Showtime will wait to see people like that until there's a big, if John Jones and Ngannou are available, then Showtime's calling on Bellator and saying, listen, we're going to give you guys 80% of the pay-per-view cut, and no one sells pay-per-views better outside the UFC than Showtime.
And if so Bellator could make like a deal with a boxing MMA type deal, then maybe that would be something that could potentially lure them in, right? If they get creative. So I don't know.
Have something like that? Huh? Boxing. Doesn't Chris Cyborg have something like that with Bellator?
I think, but I don't recall seeing her box yet.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. But if you weave that in, that would also make it harder for the UFC to match, would it not? I don't know. You guys are the attorneys. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not really an attorney. Oh, you're talking those two. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think that's the Eddie Alvarez situation, right? Remember his lawsuit where they tried to Bellator tried to match and offered to sweeten pot. But basically, like Kurt had said, I think it's just money on money. That it's not any kind of enticements or things like that. You just have to match up the money. You know, I don't know what the UFC would do with Ngannou. You know, would they match him and then put him on ice for a little bit? You know, that's kind of the thing. I think, you know, just based on what you saw last night and the fact that Dana White didn't want to belt him at the end of the fight, which I thought was like weird. There might be an impasse, and you know, maybe they'll just offer a buyout to Francis, saying, you know, hey, buy out the rest of your terms so you could go fight now. I don't know.
Yeah, but one thing we've also learned about the UFC is when you're at an impasse and they don't like you, that can change really quick. If it's in their interest to like you again, they can come around pretty quick.
Yeah, I mean he's definitely a star, right? I mean, some of those knockouts are just, you know, the Overeem one is just like, you know, unreal. It's like, you know, cartoon stuff. But you know, again, in terms of MMA, I mean, you know, there really aren't that many fights even in the UFC for him, right? I mean, he's other than Derek Lewis, he's pretty much run, and John Jones, he's run the table. I mean, unless you get Cormier back in the mix, but I mean, Cormier is what, in his early 40s now? I mean, you don't want none of that.
I think you're right, Kurt. I mean, there's no one that the UFC has that they can build a big fight feel around, except for like a guy like Lewis. Or bring back John Jones. I mean, they have heavyweights, but they don't have anyone at that level where they could just build them up to fight a guy. I don't know. You tell me, Curtis. It's kind of like how they try to groom an opponent for a Canelo. You know, everybody. You know, it has to be a certain type of opponent for him to want to enter the ring. So. But I just love when Canelo just likes to sing the payday thing whenever everybody wants to fight him. He'd payday.
My opponent for Ngannou is Tai Tuivasa. You just build a huge shoe that you put the cage in. That'll sell the fight. In a weird way, the Ngannou deal should be almost like, we're going to give you a bunch of fights against second ring guys for guaranteed money, and you can fight as many as you want. And then we'll give you a huge split when you get against a guy that we can put on pay-per-view and make a lot of money, because that's kind of where, I mean, who knows? Maybe someone makes an offer like they did with Wilder. Remember when DAZN offered them that deal and Showtime had a match, they paid him a ton his next two fights, even before the Fury fight, even though they lost millions on those fights because they wanted him on their platform. They wanted to keep a PBC to save him for that Fury fight. So maybe there's that. Maybe someone will say, here's about throwing outside the box, and I don't think it's a possibility. But what if ESPN says, or Showtime, I mean, and Belter says, we have Rumble Johnson. We're convinced that we can turn Rumble Johnson, have him knock out a couple heavyweights, and people will want to see him against Ngannou. Let's give Ngannou a guaranteed $5 million a fight for his first couple fights to knock out our second-rate heavyweights that we have. And then we can put those guys, and we'll recoup the loss by having a big pay-per-view. Is that logical? I mean, seems logical in a boxing sense, and MMA seems kind of illogical, but
I think your original thought, John, was spot on, where, you know, how much time does Stipe have left on his contract? How much time does Derek Lewis have left? How much time does John Jones, like if Ngannou can run through, you know, Ryan Bader and, you know, Valentin Moldavsky and Czech Congo, and if they dust off and dig up Fedor and throw, you know, push him into the ring. Right.
Any athletic commission that approves that fight deserves to be decided. But you know what? I wonder how much, as sad as that fight would be, how much does Fedor versus Ngannou sell? Does that sell at all or not?
Yeah. People bought Mike Tyson coming back, so I would assume that Fader coming back for the MMA fan would be...
It's a live execution. We're going to have this old man get in there and get beheaded.
Well, I assume this is happening in Texas, correct? I mean, yeah. Dallas State, Texas,
or Florida,
or Florida, yeah. But I mean, I people would tune in to see it. I mean, you know,
he's got a lot more possibilities than we thought. If he can sell Fader, then there's that throws a whole other promotion in the mix that has a possibility to go after him. So,
I mean, I just think that Ngannou does have a lot of options out there. I mean, it just depends on what he wants to do, what his management wants to do as far as a path. You know, he could definitely wait out a year. He could go to another MMA organization, do boxing. I think he is in a good place after this year. I just don't know what this year holds for him. So,
yeah,
right. I mean, to my mind, you know, just looking on the boxing, you know, slash freak show side of it, to me, Triller, I mean, just seems to have, you know, a bottomless pit of money, and they have this triad thing. He seems to fit that just absolutely perfectly. And, you know, I'm sure they can find enough, you know, heavyweights, boxers that he can, you know, push in a corner and beat the crap out of, you know.
You can get in there and be like, wait, dust off Frank Mir again. Why did I work on my wrestling so hard the last few years?
Yeah. What's interesting is it's obvious that UFC could pay the most, and I think we all agree they could, but none of us really see them as matching some ridiculous Triller offer. So, no. I mean, I'd be happy. I actually would be happy. The UFC came back and said, we'll match those guys and we want you to fight, you know, Jones and Lewis and rematch gone. Well, that might be boring, but you know, and Lewis wasn't that good the first time anyways, but I'd still watch it. But still, you know, we'll match. We'll give you that 10, 15, 20 million that you can get out, you know, with these other promotions. We'll give you the UFC. I'd be happy, but I don't see it happening.
Business strategy.
But you know what? Since we have a boxing expert on here, we should probably ask him.
Really quick, John, are you transitioning to the Terrence Crawford?
Yeah, I was.
Because I had one more question for Kurt, just related to contracts.
Okay.
Which is just, I just wanted to know your take, right? As someone who's really immersed in boxing, and like these new contract terms of the UFC, the 5-year max or the 4-year max, getting rid of exclusive negotiating periods, still having 12-month right to match, those sorts of things, like, how do those match up with what you see in boxing? Kind of these terms and the newer ones versus what you tend to see in boxing. I'm just curious. I hope other people are.
I'll be honest with you. I don't see sunset provisions too much in boxing. That's actually a contract provision that's like more fighter friendly in the UFC than it is in boxing. Right to match, definitely. There's a ton of that. Any sophisticated promoter is going to have probably, you know, the right of first negotiation, last refusal, or, you know, right to match. You know, I think, you know, not, you know, boxing doesn't have a video game. So the tattoo rights that John was talking about, that's, we haven't quite got there yet. Trying to think, what else did you have in there, John, in your article?
Well, the video games, right? I'm trying to remember I can't remember. Oh, I mean, just the beginning, the recitals that were obviously kind of addressed to the antitrust lawsuit. But I will say, and you know this, Kurt, better than me probably, is that a lot of states, though, have 5-year maximums for boxing. Like California has a 5-year maximum in their state regulations.
Yeah, was it 5 or 7? I can't remember the De La Hoya case.
Olivia de Havilland was 7 for actors, but it's 5 for boxing. They narrowed it to 5 for boxing.
Okay. So, yeah.
In fact, that's when someone suggested that's why Endeavor did it, because they're in California. So if you're going to have a maximum, follow the California regulations.
Yeah, without question. But also, yeah, you know, it's all about the suit, man. I mean, they don't make any of these changes without that antitrust suit. So, you know, everything would have stayed the same if they didn't get hammered with that suit.
That's
because they got to be afraid of losing that suit at this point. It's been going on for so long. Yeah.
Well, Paul doesn't think they're going to lose, but
I don't think they're afraid of losing yet. I think they're annoyed by it and annoyed by the amount of money they have to spend on it. But I don't think quite yet they're afraid of losing.
I'm in the midpoint between what you guys are saying, because I think they've got to be concerned because the end result is so ridiculously big, potential damages. But it's like, well, if we can make some changes and mitigate and end the damage possibility, well, we can keep fighting, let the case draw out. And then if we can't win and we have to settle, at the point where they're, I mean, they're at $1 billion in revenue almost right now and $500 million in earnings. When they have to settle for even $500 million, like, well, that's 1 year of earnings. We'll spread out over 4 years. We'll be fine. You know, it's not, what it used to be in a catastrophic apocalypse for them when this lawsuit was filed is now just going to be an accounting piece on the ledger. Exactly. Like, we're done.
Yeah. Right. It's like, which pair of pants did I leave that $500 million in? Yeah, let me reach into there.
And let's try to make sure that this something like this doesn't get brought against us in the future.
Exactly. You know what I mean? We completely ended it. And now, but I mean, it's kind of the best of everything because for fans, it's the end of the UFC. Nope. The UFC is not going to take a hit, but the end result hopefully be the fighters that fought get a big lump of sum to make up for how little they make. And going forward, there are some changes, and maybe they'll add a few more if, you know, fighters are lucky, but there's some changes. So, you know, it's kind of the best you could have hoped for to begin with. So, you know, and which I, and, you know, hey, hats off Kung Lee for filing. You know, people didn't give those guys, it's hilarious how little attention those guys have gotten, except for us. Us and Josh Gross, the only guys at the hearing.
I mean, it might not be a home run for those guys, but they put the ball in play. So, I mean, I think that they'll be, I mean, like you said, the sunset provisions will be, are a move in the right direction. And, you know, hopefully for the people that did file the lawsuit, there'll be some sort of compensation at the end of the road. So.
All right. Well, I'm sure we'll end up, we always end up talking about that all throughout the show. I'm sure we'll end up talking about that some more somehow, some way when I'm complaining about Judge Bullwear. But let's get to our next issue with Kurt, the Terrence Crawford lawsuit. Who wants to handle that? I'm not nearly as familiar with it as you guys are, so I'm going to let Jason or John.
Let Jason do it. He wrote a whole thing about it. So
I wrote a whole thing about it. So it's an interesting lawsuit that Terrence Crawford. Kurt, you could help me fill in the lines here, but Terrence Crawford filed a lawsuit against Bob Arum. The salacious part is the inference of racism against Bob Arum. I mean, like, he's an old white guy. Hey, I don't know. Obviously, the issue that comes down to it is a couple things. For a breach of contract that Crawford had sued Top Rank. And he's alleging, now he alleged two big things, and I haven't brought up the suit, but so forgive me if you will. He was supposed to have received a pay for a fight, two fights, is that correct? Do you remember, Kurt? What Crawford was supposed to do here?
You mean like the initial like breach of contract?
Yeah.
I mean, basically, it's a 3-year contract, and each year he was guaranteed two fights. So, contract year one they met it. Contract year two they're alleging that they did not meet it. But contract year three, even though I think the second fight took place beyond the final year date, they're actually giving Top Rank a mulligan on that one, saying that the bout agreement was actually signed within the contract year, contract year three. So they're only alleging a breach of not providing one of the six fights that they owed under the contract.
And it was 2019, right? Is that right?
It started, it went like October to October, like October 2018 to October 2019. And then year two was 19 to 20. And then and that's the one. Yeah. I mean, October 2019 to October 2020. What happened in between?
I don't know.
Those dates that might have caused you not to be able to offer. I mean, I can't think of anything.
I mean, this thing is similar in nature to what Canelo had, the Canelo dust up with DAZN in similar ways in that they wanted fights during the pandemic and they just couldn't get them done. Wouldn't that be Top Rank's first off argument about not being able to get Crawford a fight?
Well, you know, what's interesting, Jason, I think you pointed this out because I listened to is it the legal submission?
You're right, the legal submission. Wait, my God.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I stalked you guys.
Wait. Where? I want to know. Did you listen to it? Because I tweeted the link. That's all.
Yes. Oh, my God. And you know
I think I actually went to MMA Payout and found it, to be honest.
God. Oh, my God. I am blushing because, guys, I'm so happy. And, by the way, I just got the trademark for it. So there you go.
All right. Congrats.
Well, we'll see. So it was similar to the Canelo in nature because he wanted a fight, but they top ranked didn't afford him one. And then I think the second issue was he was supposed to get a they were conditioning him fighting, I forget the guy's name, Eagle.
Kavalauskas. Yeah. Just call it Mean Machine. Mean Machine.
They were offering Mean Machine here's a contract issue, with the opportunity to fight, to negotiate an Errol Spence fight if he took the Mean Machine fight, correct? Was that right? And
yeah, it's really bizarre. And what I was going to say about your podcast is one of the things you mentioned was that it was a little odd that they didn't include the contracts with the complaint. I mean, that's often when you file a breach of contract suit, it's not an obligation, not everywhere. Some places it is, but you know, they didn't include the contracts. And what's funny is, you know, in my experience, and I've seen a few top ranked contracts over the years, you know what provision they don't have in those contracts? Force majeure.
Huh.
They don't have a force majeure in there.
Really?
Not only that, I mean, we'll see. We'll see when the contract comes out. I mean, I'm just going off of, you know, things that maybe it was a couple of years ago that I saw these, but you know, I just happened to, you know, when Crawford filed the complaint and I didn't see a contract, I'm like, well, let me see what a contract, you know, a top rank contract looks like. No force majeure. And to me, you know, I mean, they need to really be kicking themselves because there's a litigation going on here in New York between a New York promoter. I mean, I guess you can mention them. It's public documents. DiBella is in litigation with Oshaki Foster, one of his fighters.
Yes.
One of the allegations or one of the issues was, you know, whether, you know, the force majeure clause applied. I mean, obviously there's been a ton of litigation on force majeure since the COVID breakout. And it just so happened that, you know, DiBella's attorney, Alex Dombroff, shout out, had a really well-crafted force majeure clause in there, and it made a big difference in the case. So that's one thing I'm going to keep an eye on with this. Now, maybe you don't need a force majeure clause in there. Maybe you can still make some sort of impossibility or commercial impossibility argument, but it sure is a lot easier when you have a force majeure clause in.
I was going to point out that the one thing is that Foster contract was included in that filing.
Yeah, exactly. And Top Rank should get a copy of that and look at the force majeure clause and cut and paste. But with the Kavalauskas thing, just really bizarre. Like, basically, okay, so I remember when the Kavalauskas fight was announced, it was literally like maybe a day or two after Spence's car crash. Right. I think he crashed that car and got in this horrific accident like October 10th. And I believe they announced like the Kavalauskas Crawford fight, like the 13th or the 14th. So I'm like, were the negotiations like going down to the last minute? They put this clause in there. And according to the complaint, because again, we don't have the contracts, but they basically made it like, okay, we're going, if Spence can fight. So you would think they had the car crash in mind, and they're probably thinking, this guy's that, you know, he's never fighting again. So they're basically like, okay, you know, we will get you the Spence fight. Just take the Kavalauskas fight. But okay, just in case, you know, we can't make the Spence fight and he's able to fight by the end of 2020. If we can't make that fight and he's able to fight, we'll give you, you know, $900,000. How about that? You know, now you're going to take the Kavalauskas fight? Yeah, all right, says Crawford. So that's kind of the second allegation is basically they put all that stuff in there. And sure enough, Spence heals, fights by the end of 2020. And they're saying Top Rank still didn't pay him the $900,000 that they negotiate. So, but it's really bizarre. It's really bizarre. Like I've, you know, I don't think I've ever seen, I mean, I'm not saying it's never happened, but I've never seen any like a bout agreement that was contingent on a guy who's just got into a car accident and whether he's going to be able to fight within a year's time. And if we can make a fight with him, but if we can't, we'll give you about $1 million, not quite $1 million, about $900,000. Just really, it's really bizarre. It's a bizarre thing. I can't wait to see the contract.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you then, how do you think those negotiations went? Because I assume that maybe Top Rank started out with a lower number. And then, you know, maybe Crawford's camp said, you know, 1.5, you know, 800,000, 1 million. Okay, we'll meet you at 900,000. I mean, because it seems 900,000 doesn't seem like a, you know, a number there that's already, you know, a solid number there. And then also, I mean, at that time, people thought Spence was wouldn't be able to walk, or you know, right, if he was dead, he could die, that kind of thing. So, how you know, Gallows with that, where it's just like, well, you could fight his carcass. I mean, if he comes out of this thing, I mean, it seems weird that comes out. I mean, and then it's, thank you so much for bringing up that timeline, because I don't think I recalled specifically when Spence's car crash was, because, and that was a pretty bad Brad car crash, because people didn't think that he would make it out of there.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's just, you know, also a little bit of context. I mean, I think I remember, and you know, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, I haven't researched it, but I remember somewhere along the line where there were discussions while the pandemic was going on in Top Rank. And that's another thing too about tolling. You know, A, you don't have the force majeure in there, which would give you tolling, right? But B, Top Rank has the bad luck of being the first ones back. Like, they actually were promoting fights in June. So, you know, at the most, they can maybe toll 3 months, right? The contract, you know, to say, okay, we didn't get you 2 fights, but, you know, should have been at least, you know, 3 months grace there because of the pandemic. But I vaguely recall Crawford, you know, there being rumors that Crawford was just like one of those guys, I don't care if there's not a crowd, I'm not taking pay cut. You know, so I think there was definitely some back and forth and some enmity, like, you know, Top Rank probably approached him like, dude, you know, you cost us a lot of money. I don't know, you know, with no gate, you know, we may not be able to pay you what we're obligated. And he's just like, uh-uh. So, you know, I mean, in the complaint, they're saying he doesn't want to face Kavalauskas, but, you know, I mean, you know, the history of Crawford and the PBC, I mean, they pretty much played keep away from him as soon as he won the title. So just, you know, I mean, he finally did get Porter at the end of 2021, but for the most part, yeah, PBC wasn't helping him out. Like, they're just like, no, you know, we're gonna wait till you get old before you fight Spence. So, and that also kind of goes to this second allegation. You know, Crawford knew that was going on, right? Like, he knew that the PBC and Spence pretty much didn't want any part of him. I mean, they almost said as much in media interviews. Like, why, you know, I interviewed Tim Smith on my podcast, and he was just like, listen, if Top Rank had all the welterweights and Errol Spence was sitting over here by himself, you don't think they'd be doing the same thing we're doing? Playing keep away? So, you know, all this is in the air. Crawford knows, you know, so if he was holding out for, I mean, I'm sure he's very frustrated. Like, let's make the Spence fight. But just that whole provision, I mean, it was, you know, it was probably right after the car crash. I'm like, who was the genius at Top Rank who thought of this thing? You know, just like, I don't know where that thing came from. It's just such a bizarre provision. And that, and they didn't even pay up on the 900. So it's just really bizarre. It's come back to bite them.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely bizarre. And then, I mean, what do you think of this? All of the, I mean, I think the PR battle, of course, was the Crawford allegations of racism and things like that. What do you think about how that plays out in the media? And obviously, we know that it probably won't have any effect with respect to the breach of contract claims. But how do you think that plays out in the media?
Yeah, Jason, I mean, I think you said this too in your podcast. You're like, okay, you know, it's very front loaded at the beginning and it's spiced a little bit, but how does it tie into the causes of action? You know, like, there's really not a clear tie. I mean, I guess maybe when you get down to the end, there's like a tortious,
tortious interference with the contract or
something. No, it was tortious. I've never seen tortious breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, which we've been talking about.
There it is again. Yeah.
That sounds like someone just missed a couple commas. Multiple allegations.
Someone like was mixing and matching causes of action,
Hey, that seems really mad. I'm mad at the breach of this contract, but I'm going to do it.
That's right. Well, I should ask for both of you guys, is it possible, because I saw someone mentioned that a lot of the racist arguments was for almost like, we're going to embarrass you if we go to court, because in discovery, we can expand what we can look for because we're making these allegations. I don't know if that's true or not. Is that possible? Like, hey, you better settle, because if this goes, if we go forward with this, we're going to go into discovery and we're going to ask for searches of items, word searches for stuff that's very, it's going to be, remember Golden Boy and PBC, you don't want that to happen again.
They're going to find the John Gruden emails with Aaron.
Who knew? But to your point, John, and Kirk can chime in as well. I think just from the litigation standpoint with discovery, Top Rank's going to be very contentious as far as how these things come out. They are not going to give up any of these emails or texts or whatnot or any inferences of racism without a huge fight. They're going to just basically say that any kind of references to racism has no impact on the breach of contract. That's if you're Top Rank's attorneys, that's the strategy. Like, whatever you're saying, did he breach the contract? It doesn't matter if he said XYZ. It's right. Whether or not he agreed to the contract. What was going on now? And I think the one thing that we maybe gloss over is the force majeure provision. A force majeure provision basically excuses someone to the contract, excuses them from doing what they were going to do. So
for an act of God like
a force majeure. Pandemic. Yes, exactly. We can't pay you the gate because there's no gate. Because right, we can't bring people. The government has told us we cannot come. So we can't pay you the gate, Terrence Crawford. Look at the contract. There is the provision. So that's force majeure. I believe it's act of God in French. John. Force majeure. What is that?
Yes. But it's not act of God. It's a fort. Oh, man. What is it again? It's I can't remember it because that's not God. It's force of nature. No, it's what does force majeure mean?
It's a French word. But
but there goes my French, just terrible right now.
I screwed it up too.
I had a question thrown in there that you brought something up that was interesting, and now I've kind of forgot it. Oh, well, first of all, yes, you don't have to describe force majeure because our viewers are fucking geniuses and they all know.
Well, they know French. That's
they're all experts at everything. That's why you're watching this show. You're not a mouth breather like the rest of the MMA shows. You are on a show we know we're talking about. But okay, on the racism thing, the search stuff. Okay, if that's denied, but is there an argument like that? His argument of Crawford's of Bob Arum being racist, isn't it like, well, you re-signed with the man twice, and all the stuff you bring up is publicly known information. Him going to South Africa is not hidden. It wasn't like you suddenly were revealed to you. This has been a criticism against him for years. So,
honestly, as I was pouring through this, I think where the racism probably ties in is the normal breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Just your run of the mill breach of covenant, of the covenant of good faith, fair dealing. And the argument they're making is that, once Arum found out that Crawford wasn't going to re-sign, then he started like putting him down, saying, that he couldn't earn, he wasn't marketable. And they're trying to, if they're going to tie the race stuff in, that's where it is. Like, he's unmarketable. He doesn't sell tickets because he's black. But to me, the interesting part about that is generally with a breach of a covenant and good faith and fair dealing, you're talking about something that pertains to the contract you're in. What they were kind of arguing in the complaint was what Arum was doing was hurting his future earnings. Hmm. with, you know, potential promoters who are going to sign him once the contract's over. And myself, I haven't done enough research on the breach of covenant and good faith and fair dealing to know if it applies to, like, you know, future earnings and future damages, or if it just applies to your damages under the contract that you were in with the person you're suing. So that's something that can be looked up. You know, maybe you absolutely can, and that's why they put that in there and they phrase it the way they did. But if not, then, you know, then I really don't know why they have all the race stuff in there. But I, you know, in a way though, I think a lot of that is probably, you know, Terrence Crawford, the client, saying, you know what, you better put some, this guy's racist, he's this, he's that. And they start doing some research and they're like, wow, Aram says some really fucked up things. Yeah, we can do a lot with this.
You know, and to be honest with you, it for the plaintiff, Terrence Crawford, it's not going to hurt.
Right.
I mean, it could only help. I mean, because you got the media looking at this and they're going to talk about this. I mean, they're going to talk about more than just saying, oh, there's some contract he breached, whatever, whatever. But they're going to say, Bob Arum's racist. Well, I knew he was racist. Look at this. And then, you know, you get into maybe some pressure for Arum to, like, let's squash this and deal with it. Maybe there's a settlement involved. Maybe they, you know, cut Crawford loose, whatever. And just as an aside, the breach, the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in a contract was my second jury trial, and I lost. And so that's why I hate that fucking thing. I just remember, like, just dealing with that contractual, you know, what is it, you know, I don't know what the fuck it is. So anyway, it's definitely a legitimate cause of action, because I've had to deal with it.
But if Crawford feels that Arum is racist, that makes sense. They would include it. I mean, it's hard to prove. It's, you know, in a subjective thing like that, it's like, yes, he might very well be. I mean, Arum, there's I could understand the suspicion about some of his points of view, but he's not as blatant as other people. But it is kind of, and it also might be the generational descriptions of, you know, different, because if you're McWhorter, there's, we view racism completely different across generations, what it is. But anyways, but is it also possible, because I noticed Lauren Mack, you remember, he had an accusation of racism against Chaudhry in his lawsuit. And so, Is it based on the fact that Crawford believes it, or is it just something? Is this a trend that people inserted for a reason? I was just curious, because first thing came to mind is the Lauren Mack lawsuit had an accusation against, which is a harder one to prove in U.S. courts, because Lauren Mack is white and Chaudhry is a guy from the, you know, he's, I think, of what is he, a Chinese descent? Saying he's from Singapore, but yeah, so.
You know, obviously, I think, like, it just from the media perspective, I think it gets more eyes when you talk about racism. I mean, definitely. I mean, obviously, Crawford, maybe he believes that that's why he was held down. Maybe, he wanted to point this out. And if he wanted to, I mean, obviously, you know, when you file a lawsuit against somebody, you're going to go to battle. You're going to fight it out. And you might as well, you know, if you're going to go aggressive, just like litigators like to do, you know, they're going to go out and be as aggressive as you possibly can. It's going to be a contentious battle. I mean, that's how it goes. And so, yeah, so.
It's interesting. Go ahead, Paul.
Oh, no, go ahead. Oh, I have a dumb question to throw out there. I'm sure it's a dumb question, but I was like you guys, reading through the media articles, looking kind of, trying to figure out what the legal cause of action was as I was reading through it, right? And the claims of racism might be true, and there might be documentation if you get to search emails and text messages and things of that sort. But the one thing I was wondering does that help your underlying case in court, not in the court of public opinion, but in actual court? But does it also open you up to, this is the possible dumb question, does it also open you up more to possibly being countersued by Top Rank when you say something like that? If they're convinced it's not true, or are you allowed to make those claims? And
defamation.
We can't really. Can you counter sue for defamation from something claimed in a complaint? Like that's the sense in which I think this is a dumb question. I have no idea.
Wouldn't you have to show that some sort of damages resulting from it? I guess
it's harder for a public figure. I mean, yeah. I don't know, Kurt. Well, what do you think? It's harder for a perfect figure to.
I think this is a question I was actually trying to look up really quick before I got in here, because I thought, you know, people have kind of wondered that. And my sense, just having seen a little bit of this, was that the judiciary generally tries to, you know, protect the, you know, allegations in a complaint as just like an opinion or, you know, as just allegations, you know, to be able to, you know, if they opened it up to being able to sue for libel for things that you put in a complaint, I think they generally are, you know, they frown upon that. But again, it's not, you know, I'd have to do a little more research on it. But yeah, it's a great question, because I mean, these are, you know, when you call someone racist, I mean, people have lost jobs, you know, people have lost complete careers over stuff. It's a very heavy allegation to make. And, you know, like we've all been saying, it very, very well may be true. And I think when Aram started talking about Crawford and tearing him down, when this guy's supposed to be one of the best fighters he's got, and like everyone in boxing was just looking at each other like, what is Bob doing? You know, what happened? Like, why is he shitting on his own fighter? You know, it just didn't make any sense. I mean, they rationalized it in the complaint saying, well, this was about the time that Aram found out Crawford wasn't going to re-sign with him. So he was basically destroying any, you know, his reputation to future promoters and so on. And, you know, and that's where you get this, you know, breach of covenant and of good faith and fair dealing, because what he was saying wasn't necessarily a breach of something, some explicit provision in the contract. It was a breach of the spirit of the contract. You just don't do that. You don't, you know, you're supposed to promote the fighter and, you know, try and maximize his value or just the value of the events, you know, by tearing down the, you know, what are you doing? And they, you know, feel it was race driven, or, you know, that's what they have in the complaint. But what's interesting is that this shows up a lot in boxing. This cause of action, breach of covenant, of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And the reason it does is because Buster Douglas, brought this against Don King, right after because he was under contract to King still after he beat Tyson. And if you can remember back that far, or if you weren't, if you're, you know, I'm old, so I remember it. But, when Buster beat Tyson, both Buster and Tyson were under contract to Don King. And in the eighth round of that fight, Buster was winning handily. He gets hit with a wild uppercut from Tyson. He goes down. The referee picks up the count and gives him like the slowest eight count like in the history of the game. Buster gets up, you know, beats the count, and Don King's going apoplectic, because in boxing, and maybe it isn't the same in MMA because you don't have counts. The timekeeper starts the count, right? Mm-hmm. And if you're waving a guy to the neutral corner, the referee's supposed to make sure the guy's in the neutral corner. And then he picks up the count from the timekeeper. Somehow, some way, the referee and the timekeeper were just off, and the timekeeper hit 10 before Buster got up. So Don King's going out like, this fight should be over, you know, this and that. I mean, to be honest, he had a decent argument, right? But, you know, then a couple rounds later, you know, Buster, you know, the bell rings, Buster survives, you know, he knocks out Tyson. So after the fight, you know, Buster's celebrating, and Don's going, you know, because his meal ticket just got beat by like this unknown guy. So basically he goes to the WBC and the WBA and all the representatives there, and he makes the argument, listen, this was a long count. This result should be thrown out. Mike Tyson should have won this fight. You know, he should still be champion. So one of the, you know, Buster then, you know, with Don King working against him, filed suit. And, you know, there wasn't, you know, and this was basically the only way he could come at him. You know, it wasn't a specific breach of the contract, but it was a breach of the, you know, covenant of good faith and fair dealing. You're not supposed to work against your guy, you know? So he basically, I mean, it didn't go to trial, but he beat a summary judgment motion on it. And the judge was just like, you know, if there ever was like a breach of covenant of good faith and fair dealing, it's where, you know, your promoter who promotes, you know, two guys is, you know, blatantly, you know, partisan and trying to, you know, favoring one over the other and trying to take away, you know, the biggest prize in the sport away from one of them and giving it back to the other. So that's kind of, you know, reading the Douglas case, like, it is really informative on a couple of these causes of action, because the tortious breach of covenant and good faith and fair dealing, the elements of it, there has to be a fiduciary duty, right? And one of the things that was established in Douglas versus DKP is that promoters, unless they establish a very special relationship, which they almost had with DKP and Buster, but they kind of, Buster's own people messed it up in the deposition testimony by basically saying that Don did not have a special relationship with him and then tried to allege it in the papers. But from that case, like going forward, I know in America Presents versus Hopkins, they just basically said, listen, absent a special circumstances, an ordinary relationship between a promoter and a boxer in a contract is not, you know, there's no fiduciary duty there. There's no special relationship. So honestly, this tortious breach of good faith and fair dealing, if you're saying Arum's a racist, and like, I think you're pretty much eliminating the special relationship that could exist that might establish a fiduciary duty between Top Rank and Crawford. So I would dare say that cause of action has no chance in hell. But the breach of covenant and of good faith and fair dealing for him, you know, essentially, you know, destroying the marketability of his fighter or cutting at his fighter, you know, that might have some life. I'm sorry, I'm going on here. Sorry, I don't need a lecture.
That's so interesting. I didn't know that story.
That's a great story. Actually, you could correct me if I'm wrong, and maybe I'm misremembering this, but didn't Don King sign Buster Douglas only like shortly before that to a multi-fight agreement? And then because for whatever reason, he just wanted him on his roster and then decided to throw him against Tyson while they were waiting for a Holyfield. If I remember, maybe I'm wrong, but that's why I remember. I thought it was a recent signing to King. And then at that point, he thought he was being used by King.
He didn't just sign him. He did sign him, and believe it or not, I mean, it's hard to believe in boxing these days, but he promised Buster four fights a year. And again, in that case, what's really interesting but could apply to the Crawford case is he missed one of those fights. He didn't provide all four fights. So, yeah. You know, he breached the contract and they tried to get out with that. But what's interesting is that the judge found that Buster had waived the breach because basically he said, and it's really interesting because King had actually, and again, yeah. I'm going to really get into the nitty gritty.
Okay, so we follow. Maybe I'm going to say, but like Buster signed with King, if I remember right, like in 88 or something like that. And then he was supposed to get four fights a year. God, I'm trying to remember because I read this case because I think you sent it to me a long time ago. And then was he supposed to be on the undercard and he got yanked from the fight or something? And that's one of the fights he didn't get. And then
What's funny in this change, this altered the course of boxing promotional agreements. This is why you have certain language now that you didn't have then. Don used to put in his contracts that that he would promote four fights of Douglas, not offer, but promote four fights. So what happened was he had actually sent a bout agreement. Buster was supposed to fight this kid from Canada who was journeyman named Ken Lacusta. He's going to get paid $40,000 for it. And Tyson had to pull out of the main event because of an injury. So they canceled the whole card. And the judge was just like, listen, you know, that's all fine and good, you know, but you promised to promote four of his fights. And just because the main event went out, you know, doesn't mean you couldn't have put the undercard on as the card. And whether you lost money or not is not a consideration. You know, like you could have put this card on. You lose money, but you're obligated to promote four fights by this guy. So you breached. But again, in deposition testimony, boy, these were like the worst like plaintiff or defendants ever prepared by lawyers. They basically said that, you know what? Yeah, we didn't get the Lucchese fight. We didn't really care about that fight. You know, the fight we really wanted was Tyson. So you know, when we got the Tyson fight, it really didn't matter to us. So the judge was like, listen, these guys never sent like a letter of breach. They never like, you know, said a word to King about him breaching the contract. Then they got the Tyson fight. So in essence, they waived the breach. So, you know, how does that apply to the Crawford case? Well, he's basically saying that these guys didn't get him two fights like 2 years ago, right? I mean, did he send a letter of breach? You know, did he put notes? And again, Top Rank's contracts, unlike a lot of boxing promotional contracts, does not have a notice and cure provision in there, at least the last one I saw. There's no like, if you breach, then, you know, you must send notice and we'll have 30 days to cure or 6 months to cure. The last Top Rank, and again, we have to see the contracts, but you know, years ago or some public filing, I know I looked at the Top Rank contract and I'm like, why is there not a notice of a breach and a cure provision in here? So Crawford wasn't obligated to send one. So that could be his comeback. But, you know, Don, I think might have had the notice. I know certainly going forward, they had him in there. But again, yeah, the Douglas case is very informative to read when you're looking at this Crawford complaint, because a lot of the same causes of action and, you know, some of the same breaches that are alleged in this are came up in that case.
Wow.
You're going to make us do research in history.
That's fascinating. I did not know all that.
You should have them set. You should send those guys the other cases that you sent me. You know, the about the you know, the right to own your contract, your rank, all those.
Oh, dude, I was gonna make a comment because you sent all the. Well, I don't know if I should say. Yeah. I remember seeing the UFC provisions in these contracts you're talking about in your article. Yeah.
You know, yeah. I already said that I showed them to you. So it's not a secret.
He showed them to Kurt, but not me and Jason.
I was sure I sent it to you guys. I was sure. I thought, in fact, that you said to look at, I thought I copied and pasted that in there. So
hold on. What was the provision? It had to do with maybe the championships one. Hold on. Let me look. Which is the one where they talk about property rights?
Oh, is it? Wait, is that the... Is that the merchandise part or the I can't understand. I mean, it's a
maybe
long
it's
contract.
Titles.
It's a well, there is a thing about you don't own the titles. The UFC does. And they're that is always interesting. The UFC says they're not a sanctioning organization. The titles are not actual titles or whatever that that's why they can always award. That's why you always have a new title every fight. It's not like, you know, like boxing, pro wrestling. You win the title, then you got to give it to the other guy that beats you. Every fight, you get a new title because it's you have no right to these titles.
That's why they right. send a guy a belt every a fighter, you know, a belt every time.
Exactly. I mean, obviously, it seems like they're ready for the Ali Act if that ever comes. It's not like you have no right to this title. This is not a real title. This is something we give to the between these two. This is the BMF title every time there's a championship fight.
Well, the whole thing that they have in here, and again, this is probably Lawrence Epstein because he's an old boxing guy, but yeah, it says additionally, you know, this is title and championship belts. Additionally, Fighter expressly acknowledges and agrees that Zuffa is not a sanctioning organization, and Fighter does not possess and cannot assert any property right or similar legal interest in the belt, any UFC title or status as a UFC champion. Now, the whole property right thing stems from an old case. And it's funny, my very first Boxing Esquire podcast, I had Pat English on. And Pat talked about this case because I really wanted him to talk about it because it's interesting. It was Duva versus WBA, 1982. Tony Ayala was rated number four in the ratings. Number three in the ratings, a junior middleweight. And the champion was supposed to fight the highest leading available contender. And they passed him over because there was a more lucrative fight in South Africa for the number four contender. So at the time, the WBA was like what the ABC is now. They were originally called the NBA, which was the National Boxing Association. So they, in the United States, like representatives from all the state commissions were members of the WBA. So Pat and Main Events made the argument that because they consisted of state-appointed officials, that they were a quasi-government entity. So therefore, in order to, you know, by not giving Ayala like a hearing and a chance to defend, you know, the fact that they passed him over, they did not give him due process, and that he had a right to due process, and he had a right to defend that rating and make them enforce their rules. And basically the judge, Pat, I think when I interviewed him, said, we didn't even brief that. We kind of mentioned it, and the judge like latched onto that. And basically the judge found that, you know, that fighters had a property right in their rating because of that quasi-government action and due process. So, and Pat has said, like, there was a further case, I think it was, I don't know, Axel Schultz versus IBF, where they took it out of the quasi-governmental thing, but they, you know, fighters still have an interest, you know, in preserving their rating and so on. But when I saw that property right there, I just chuckled. I'm like, wow, they're still like, you know, fighting, Duva versus WBA, because, you know, UFC trying to say, well, you know, you don't have any property right in the belt or your rating or what have you, you know, you know, that you can't go to court and say that, you know, we took away your property right to the title. So that's where that clause comes from, and that total minutia, but
I found that fascinating. I remember when you said that we talked about that. I've actually cited that case in a few articles that I've written about how boxers, the difference between the two is boxers have a property right to the ring.
Right.
You know, MMA, right. MMA fighters, you don't like your ranking? Gone. Who cares? Don't even get it anymore.
Have we seen if Bellator has that in there too?
You know, I'll have to double check that. I bet you they do. I bet you they, it's funny is on the contrary, we were talking earlier, but UFC for the longest time we get hammered. They technically have the best contracts now, probably of the major promoters. They still have the merchandise stuff as people got to sign away, but on a lot of other stuff, it's like other promoters can keep tolling forever. And UFC now for some of their contracts, they say, well, we can only do this a couple times and we got to stop. That's huge in MMA, you know?
Yeah. And Bulwer is about to get rid of the identity rights thing. So they're probably like, damn it. Why do we put that 2-year limit on the.
Well, I think the perpetuity thing looks terrible. So I think that was their thing. Like, yeah, we gotta make it like it's not the big complaint against this is everything's forever. But, well, what's the first thing we gotta do? We gotta say it's not forever. That'll be the first thing we gotta do. So, yeah, but what's the other one that was really interesting that affects MMA? Oh, I can't remember now. Dang it. I should have thought ahead. There's a lot of cases we've gone over that are really that apply to MMA as much as boxing. And well, we've talked before, and I'm not going to drag this one out because we'll talk about this separate, but it is also fascinating. All the guidelines that the ABC have concerning like the sanctioning orgs that they never enforce. So we're sitting there like, oh, these sanctioning organizations are terrible. And like, you know, the ABC does technically have the right to step in and say, you're not ranking people right. So
right. Yeah, that is the one power that Congress gave them was to set guidelines for the ratings. And, you know, although the Congress also like said that, you know, it suggested that the sanctioning bodies follow these things. It's not that they shall.
I'll have you on at some other point. We can get off the whole boxing league
thing. Right.
That's a 7-hour, that'll be a multi-part future episode because that will not end. But Jay brings this up too. It is fascinating is that there's so many more interesting cases in boxing and MMA, partly because there's this legal precedent and rules and regulations apply to boxers that boxers can actually win a suit. So they do sue. And then they submit their contracts. We actually see what the contracts look like without having to beg people. So they're posted. So that's part of the reason why you get all these great, you know, all these great litigation in boxing because there's something at stake. In MMA, it's like, well, I can't sue because there is no protections. And on top of that, if I win, what do I get? I made 10 grand last fight. That's what I'm suing for. That's not going to do much. So,
no. Yeah, I mean, it just seems, you know, just taking it back to the beginning. Yeah, like you're saying, I mean, with Ngannou and these contract provisions, it's calculated risk, right? And at this point in time, the UFC is just like, you know what? Maybe we don't even need these owners' contracts anymore. Like, there's nobody, I'm obviously they're not happy that Ngannou is thinking about leaving and so on. But, you know, as we've kind of gone over this, it's like, where is he going to go? You know, and how long, you know, it, is it going to, start a mass exodus from the UFC? Probably not. They may lose Ngannou for a couple fights, but eventually it's like, let's say he takes a Wilder fight and gets like blasted in 30 seconds, how long is it going to take him to go back to the UFC? If it's just one big fight, in boxing, I mean, I could totally see him doing that. Like just, taking the biggest fight he can in boxing, doing the best he can. Let's say he gets the Fury fight and gets paid, $20 million. But Fury smokes him, in a couple rounds. Basically like Mayweather did with McGregor. Just, stay away from him for 2-3 rounds, let him gas and then take him apart. Where's he gonna go? Where's he gonna go after that? Boxing's not particularly viable long term, If you're gonna fight MMA, where else are you gonna go?
Yeah. It's box especially not viable if you don't have cardio, which in a lot of, he does now. Yeah. And so no matter what, even the worst of the top 25 boxers, I think their defense, Joe Smith was beating the crap out of a guy and he couldn't knock him out. Just throwing the most vicious punches, but the gloves and the defense are good enough that you're not going to get that one punch. You're not going to get anybody to open up to get the one punch and then he'll be tired by round three. And it's.
Well, yeah. Like the UFC knew what they were doing, put him in there with Gane. Cause it's like, all the boxers looking, all right, just give him a little bit of movement. He can't hit you.
I know. There was no grappling in round one, right? And he was gassed by round two. And that's not even a boxing card. Is a whole different level.
Yeah, well, I'm gassed too. I have no. I'm not blaming him for that. But no, I'm not training. But the thing about the boxing thing also is, he is what, 36? He's going to be 37, I guess. So it could be just he wants the one, two big pay, fight for an MMA promotion, get paid a month, fight boxing, get paid as much, and just retire. But I think that's the UFC thing. I think that's it, though. It's like we're going to demonstrate that you're not locked in forever. But really, you still got to go to the UFC, build your name. And by the time you leave, it's like, well, if you win on your way out, good for you. But we've squeezed the juice out of you as much as we can. And there might be one or two fights for you outside the UFC at the end. Good for you. Go make your money.
they've taken the best years of your life, and now just like a marriage, you're now left with whatever you can put piece together.
Is your door open or closed, Jason?
Yeah.
It's open. My dog was
you're just like a marriage comment.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh no, they're upstairs. Sorry.
Oh yeah, she's like, yeah, he checked before he said that about his dog. Yes. His wife doesn't know. She has a little bell on her. She can't hear it. Tells him whenever she's around. Make sure. So, oh man, oh,
awesome.
So.
Well, this has been great. If you guys have any more questions for Kurt, let's go ahead and ask him. Otherwise, you're on the East Coast, right, Kurt?
Oh my God! Yeah. No. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I,
no.
I got a ton of stuff, but I don't because it's a can. We'll have to save it because I got to go back to that boxing league stuff we had before.
Oh my gosh!
But and that just that'll go for. I'll have to talk about it at a later date.
Those boxing cases were awesome. That's good context, and I got to read those when I have a chance.
Yeah, I guess what I could do is, I'll send them to you, Jason, if you guys, post them or something, wherever you put this up.
No, you only share them with me. Those guys don't.
Yeah, no, I want to see them too. Thank you so much, Kurt. Thank you for joining us. That was extremely entertaining and educational at the same time.
I mean, as I said, this was a dream come true for me. I am a Show Money hardcore. I love you guys. This is like the best, combat sports podcast on business, on the planet. So
do we have something to give him? Do we have something to give him? For goodness.
I gave him the Zuffa shirt that we had. That's the only one that we had.
Do you have one of my books, Kurt?
I bought it, Jason. I bought your book. I listened to your podcast and I bought your book.
God bless it, man. God bless. Well, hey, I'm going to buy some ring. When's the next Ring City card? When are you guys back up?
That's a great question. Unfortunately, I can't even tell you. We're things are a little up in the air right now with Ring City and NBC and where we're going to fit. So, NBC Sports Network no longer exists, which is where we were.
Yeah.
I'm having a meeting tomorrow with our CEO. We'll figure out what's going on.
Got a pitch for you. Got a pitch to make it more exciting. you know, instead of having it in a triangle, like try literally just have the corner. That's it. They fight just the buckle is it. And that's it. One buckle and they fight right there.
You know, what's funny. I had a client when I was working for Jim Quinn, who's an amazing sports lawyer at Bergen Anderfy. And I had a client who had this idea like, you know, 5 years ago. And except their ring was an X.
Oh.
Wasn't an octagon. It wasn't a triangle. It was X.
So you could move around in the
I don't know what you could do in an X.
It's like
theirs was an X.
That might be the worst idea I've ever.
No, you could be in different parts of the X, and then
that just seems unnaturally complex to build. Like we got to spend a lot of extra energy putting together the cage ring or whatever.
It seems to me it'd only be fun if they did like that team MMA like they have in Eastern Europe, man. You know, if you have the X, you have to have someone fighting in every corner or something.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe they switch or something. You know? But you know what? We pitched it to Nick Lembo in Jersey, and he was cool. He was just like, yeah, whatever, man.
Nick Lembo? I met Nick before. So he said he actually was going to let you guys do it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Nick, I know because, you know, we're both Penn State alum. So I had to go before the athletic commission way back in the day, representing Corey Spinks, defending the referee's actions in his fight with Mayorga. And I met Len or Nick, and we started talking. Yeah, Nick's a great guy. I love Nick. He's a good guy. But yeah, it was like he was down with the X. He was down with the X.
My God, we almost opened another can of worms to talk about it. Oh my God, that's awesome. Yeah. That is awesome.
All right. Well, I will let you guys go, and I appreciate you having me on. And it was a thrill. And anytime
you
need
Kurt.
some boxing stuff, you know, I'm more than happy to come on.
Okay.
Thank you, Kurt.
Bill will be in the mail.
If you ever get out to Vegas, hey, let's grab some drinks or dinner or something.
Oh, I'd love it. I'd love it. That'd be great.
All right. Thanks for coming on.
All right, guys.
Good night.
Talk to you later.
Wow. Super fan. Turn
yeah, that was great.
That was. You know what? I mean, like, you know, I think we could easily replace any one of us now. Just hand him.
Oh my God! Yeah, my job is over.
Yeah,
man, he had those boxing cases down. Like
that was just awesome. It was like there's so many boxing cases that I've totally missed from the earlier, like from the 80s and 90s, and he's just like an encyclopedia. That's awesome.
And it gets back. It's actually fascinating because I've talked to him a couple times about this because as a source for articles, but it's also fast because those are like the pre-Aliak. So there's a lot of these cases that line up and
wild. Yeah.
Yeah. They're just like Wild West. But then they lay the foundation and that's why like the Aliak has some teeth in some ways because some of it's rooted in earlier cases. So it's like, okay, you can't do this because we're from that, but we have this. So some wild, wild stuff. Boxing's fascinating because it's just a cesspool.
Yeah. I mean,
I had no idea. Did you guys know that there was that 10 count? That
I did not either. I have to watch that again.
Yeah, well, I read the case. But I remember watching it. I remember that when it was a big deal when it happened. I remember that was a fight was a Saturday afternoon because it took place in Japan.
Right.
And I just remember that everybody went nuts because they thought they counted too long, and then there's all the people, the Tyson fans, for just months afterwards refused to acknowledge the defeat that it was fit. I don't know. It was a crazy time.
But did you know that the timekeeper hit 10? Like, there's thinking he counted too long versus knowing that the timekeeper hit 10.
Well, that I didn't know at first, but then I read the case, and there was articles back then, I think, because the lawsuit was a big deal when it took place. I remember I was really into boxing back then,
Tyson won. I had no idea.
He did not win, though. That stuff was
fun. Although the second he was talking about going after or trying to get it overturned, you know, it's like it takes you to MMA cases, right? Where the referee does something they're not supposed to do, but they didn't like intentionally make an error or something like that, and you're not like no commission's really going to overturn that. It immediately took me to MMA cases, right, where you don't see a groin shot or an eye poke or something like that.
Oh yeah, I mean, part of it probably is the I don't know the casework, but I'm sure the legal the legal reasoning is, hey, this has been settled in boxing. You get no say. Whatever happens in the ring or with the commission, that's what decides who won the match. because we're lazy as athletic commissions and government. We do not want to step in. Let their nonsense operate on its own. We don't want to have any part in it.
Well, that seemed like the perfect place to segue. We went on to discuss the UFC pay-per-view price increase, their relationship with ESPN, and some other recent business developments, but the show was just too long, so we decided to break it up. The second part should be coming out soon. And by the way, I went and watched round 8 of Tyson Douglas. The count definitely took long. By my calculations, it took about 12 and a half seconds for the ref to get to 9, and that's when Buster Douglas got up. But it also looked like Douglas was on the canvas kind of waiting on the count. So I don't think my Tyson Juan comment is necessarily correct anymore. But thank you again to Kurt Imhoff for coming on the show, for being our second guest, for sharing your insights, fascinating boxing stories. You can find Kurt on Twitter under two handles. The first is at Kurt Imhoff, KURTEMHOFF. And the second is Boxing Esquire, at Boxing underscore Esquire, ESQ. Sorry, not Esquire, underscore ESQ. On behalf of John Nash and Jason Cruz, I'm Paul Gift, reminding you to keep doing business as usual.
Thank you for listening to this Bloody Elbow Presents production. To check out more of our content, hop over to the Bloody Elbow Presents SoundCloud and iTunes pages, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is also titled Bloody Elbow Presents. We're also on Apple TV, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, Overcast, Player FM, and Amazon Music. Just search for Bloody Elbow Presents and you'll get brand new shows throughout the week, including Care Don't Care, The Mookie and Crookie Show, The Best of the Come On Now MMA Podcast, Crooklyn's Corner, The MMA Vivisection, The Level Change Podcast, Show Money, The Sixth Round Postfight Show, Sixth Round Retro, The MMA Depressed Us, and radio-style play-by-play for every UFC pay-per-view. You can also follow us on Twitter at Bloody Elbow and on Facebook at facebook.com/Bloody Elbow Blog, and of course on BloodyElbow.com.